Voices.net. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
What's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicker, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on, the Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuya, and many other indigenous nations of the Willamette and Columbia River regions. It is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationship to each other and the living world. We establish and support harmony within ourselves and set the stage for praxis.
KBOO FM, Portland, power to the people.
Welcome to Policy for the People, a show that explores the public policies that can lift up all Oregonians. This show is a collaboration between KMUZ Radio and the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I am your host, Juan Carlos Ordóñez.
Good evening. In our top story at 5, Providence nurses hit the picket lines with nearly 2,000 of them now on strike, calling for, among other things, higher wages and better mental health care.
Well, more than 150 Starbucks stores across Oregon and Washington are going on strike today.
92% of Palace Books employees voted to authorize a potential strike this week. Union members say they're looking for a living wage and better health care plan.
Strike. It's what every worker is thinking about right now. That's what Oregon AFL-CIO President Graham Traynor recently told the Northwest Labor Press. All the strike activity we're seeing right now is a hopeful sign for those who want to see an economy that works for everyone. In an earlier era, a strong labor movement led to the rise of a strong middle class. But those gains for workers began unraveling as the systems and policies protecting workers' right to organize came under fierce attack from employers and corporate interests. And as unions weakened, vast economic inequality returned with a vengeance. So what's driving the current resurgence of the labor movement and the use of strikes in particular? What challenges do workers encounter when seeking to strike? And what kinds of policy changes would strengthen workers' ability to act collectively? We discuss these questions with today's guests. Margaret Poydock, a senior policy analyst with the Economic Policy Institute, and Jennifer Shearer, director of the State Worker Power Initiative at EPI. The Economic Policy Institute, EPI, is a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank based in Washington, D.C., that seeks solutions that ensure broadly shared prosperity and opportunity. Together with other colleagues at EPI, Margaret and Jen have just published a report titled, What to Know About This Summer Strike Activity. I began by asking what the numbers say in terms of the extent to which workers are engaging in collective action, including the use of strikes. And here's how Margaret responded.
So we are seeing workers engaging in strikes, thousands of workers engaging in strikes this year. We have preliminary monthly data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which captures work stoppages of that include 1,000 or more workers, at least one work shift. And we're seeing that preliminary monthly data shows that the number of workers engaging in strikes in 2023 is likely to exceed those who engaged in strikes in 2022, which was a little bit under 200,000 workers.
And those figures don't really count all workers going on strike because it only measures strikes of 1,000 workers or more. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Like you said, the Bureau of Labor Statistics only captures work stoppages that include more than 1,000 workers, last at least one work shift Monday through Friday, and it excludes federal holidays in those numbers. And about 60% of workers are part of a firm that has less than 1,000 workers working. So this BLS data doesn't capture all the actions that are occurring across the United States right now.
What are some recent stories of workers securing better pay and working conditions by striking or threatening to strike? Jen?
Well, I think we can start maybe with just what's been a very big development this summer, which is the UPS contract settlement all across the country. So no matter where people live, in every state in the country, workers are being affected by that new contract. And in that case, what we saw was a very large bargaining unit, national in national contract negotiations, using the threat of a strike very effectively to back up their bargaining position and to really win some breakthrough improvements, including commitment to air condition those vehicles in future years, which is really a concern that workers in a lot of industries have today as we're battling climate change and heat is becoming an increasing occupational hazard. And also significant wage increases and ending some of the problems that were embedded in their inequities that were embedded in their contract before in terms of newer workers who weren't earning the same level of wages. So really big breakthrough that I think signals what lots of workers across industries are looking for right now, which is to make up for lost time in terms of wage increases that have lagged over the last four decades and to begin addressing some of the longstanding inequities across our economy. And we're seeing workers across sectors and industries use striking or the threat of striking to make progress in that way.
What about you, Margaret? Are there any other actions that you have found inspiring?
Yeah, I think this might hit close to home for your listeners and kind of follows the example of how strikes, the threat to strike can be just as powerful as going on strike. So this past May, nurses in Bend, Oregon authorized a threat to strike, but before they actually went on a planned strike, their employer, St. Charles Medical Center, was able to reach a tentative agreement with them that included historic wage increases to help recruit new nurses, but also retain current nurses, as well as provide more protections for rest and meal breaks as well. And that's just a really great example that happened in Oregon.
So all of this labor activity is coming at a time when public support for unions is at its highest level in decades. What do you think is driving this resurgence of the labor movement and the use of strikes in particular?
I think one thing that we note in the report is that we're seeing workers in some ways sort of pick up right where they left off before the pandemic. And in terms of numbers of workers striking, right, there was a real uptick in strike activity in 2018, 2019. And then the pandemic makes it look like those numbers really plummeted. But the other thing we know, because of course, BLS data don't capture all collective activities and particularly don't capture smaller groups of workers, is that the pandemic actually, you know, accelerated a lot of collective worker activity And that what we're seeing at the moment is workers taking collective action to correct power imbalances that were sharpened coming out of the pandemic, and also using the leverage of a currently, at least temporarily, tight labor market to say it's time to rebalance the scales in terms of working conditions and wages. And that, you know, workers are very aware in many cases. I think I had the chance to talk to workers on three different picket lines last month, right? And across the board, they were very aware of the profits that their employer had been making in recent quarters, and that they're not being shared with folks who are helping produce those profits. And, you know, I think workers feeling really confident that using their collective action will help them gain a fairer share of those profits.
How is it that unions help ensure that the benefits of the economy are widely spread? How it is that they're so key to ensuring broadly shared prosperity?
Well, they create really the most effective counterbalance to what is otherwise a very unequal distribution of power, both in the workplace and in the economy. As individuals, workers don't stand on equal footing with employers, who tend to have greater access to information and their own collective power to set wages and conditions. And so really, both historically and in the present, it has typically been only through banding together as a collective group and having a legal and a policy framework in place that requires an employer to meet them as equals at a bargaining table that's allowed workers to bring some balance to that employer-employee relationship. When we look at some of the charts that we share in the report, you know, the way in which eroding some of those rights over recent decades has generated an increasingly unequal distribution of income across our economy. I think what we're seeing right now with the uptick of collective worker activity is a real illustration of the consciousness across our country that inequality is not acceptable or sustainable for the vast majority of people. And a recognition that, you know, as you mentioned, you know, we're also in a moment where public approval of unions is at a high point. That all, I think, speaks to the recognition that collective action is the way we're going to address the underlying inequities in our economy.
Interest in unions is, as we've both mentioned, near record levels, but yet membership in unions is, historically speaking, at a pretty low level. I'm wondering what explains that decline in the share of workers belonging to unions, a decline that began to gain steam in the late 1970s.
Yeah, a lot of different factors to point to, but the fundamental, you know, starting point is that we have to recognize the big gap between the proportion of workers who are, as you're noting, interested in and when polled saying, I wish I had a union in my workplace, and those who actually have one. And that gap in some ways is a measure of how many roadblocks our current legal system puts in place for workers who don't right now have a union to form one, much less get to the point where they're at the bargaining table with their employer negotiating a contract. So, you know, we've had decades of erosion of the protections of workers to form a union, and everything from court decisions to board decisions and changes in federal and state policy that have made it exceedingly difficult for workers to get from wanting to have a union to actually having a union contract in place. So the union busting industry is, we have other reports on our EPI website that delve further into the reality of how effectively employers have combated workers who try to organize in our current environment. We're seeing change in that regard as well. And I think the uptick in collective action is also helping embolden policymakers who are often, you know, I would say, having to sort of catch up and recognize how important it is to restore some of the rights that have been eroded and to strengthen our federal and state laws that provide a pathway to unionization. So we have a long way to go on that score in our country, but we're seeing at least some attention, for example, like the new rules that the National Labor Relations Board issued this week, which are designed to at least take some steps in the right direction and restore some of the protection, some of the balance in the system, so that when employers break the law, at least there's a little bit more recourse for workers who are trying to unionize to get to the point of having the employer recognize and begin to bargain with them.
Can you talk about why the strike is such an important strategy for the labor movement?
The simple answer is strikes are when workers withhold their labor, you know, labor that employers depend on. And so that really, that's a form of power that workers have in order to gain better benefits or working conditions or even form a union in the first place.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to my conversation with Margaret Poydock, a senior policy analyst with the Economic Policy Institute, and Jennifer Shearer, EPI's director of the State Worker Power Initiative. We're discussing the recently released report, What to Know About This Summer's Strike Activity. The National Labor Relations Act, among other things, protects the right of workers to go on strike, but not all workers enjoy that right. Jen, who are the workers who are excluded from these protections?
Yeah, we can start by just listing that occupations, including agricultural workers, domestic workers, public sector workers, initially healthcare workers, they weren't added till much later, were explicitly left out of protection under our federal labor law when it was passed in 1935. It's very clear that those exclusions were intended to have racist impact. In other words, those occupations were not arbitrarily chosen. They were chosen because congressmen, and they were all men at the time, did not want to include coverage for large numbers of Black workers, particularly in Southern states in those occupations. So almost all those exclusions are still with us today, right? So we have entire groups of workers who don't have full protection under federal law for their labor rights. Some states have taken action to create frameworks for unionizing and collective bargaining, particularly for public sector workers. About approximately half the states in our country, a little bit more than half, have frameworks in place, although they are highly variable. Some are fairly strong and many are quite weak, and many do not include the right to strike, for example. The situation is even more dire for agricultural and domestic workers. Very few states have taken action to protect their labor rights. And so, you know, we have millions of workers who fall through the cracks in the weaknesses of our law. It's also the case that airline and railway workers are covered under a different federal law that places very significant constraints on their right to strike. And, you know, we really saw that on full display last year when rail workers were in the midst of bargaining over many of their national agreements with rail carriers. And many of them wanted to go on strike and were really constrained by the legal system that's in place there.
What does it mean to have a right to strike? What difference does it make for workers who wish to engage in a strike?
That's an excellent question. And I should have been more clear about that. That when we say someone has a legally protected right to strike, it means they are not going to face the potential that they could lose their job, that the employer could, without any consequence, retaliate in any number of ways, including losing their job permanently. Historically, of course, we know that the right to strike has often been imperiled by employers using all kinds of tactics to constrain it, including using the force of state or federal government to weigh in on their side. So having a legally protected right to strike means that you can use the framework that the laws put in place. And under the National Labor Relations Act, that means when a contract has expired, there is no strike clause long in place Workers have the right to use their economic leverage to withhold their labor, as Margaret said, in order to compel an employer to bargain more fully over the terms and conditions of what's going to be in a future contract without fear that they're going to face retaliation or lose their job. That doesn't mean that even legally protected strikes, of course, come with all kinds of risks. Economic risks, right? It means anytime workers go on strike, it generally means they're going without a paycheck. It means they're at risk of losing their health insurance coverage in most cases. Strikes are inherently involve sacrifice and risk, and it's workers really collectively making a significant decision to fight today for a better tomorrow, you know, to sort of borrow a slogan that, you know, a lot of strikers have historically carried on their picket signs.
I would also like to add that, you know, strikes are typically the last resort too. It's not the first choice for workers. It's because of the risks that are involved and the obstacles that workers face when they go on strike too. So that makes it even more impactful as they go on strike.
So let's switch gears here and talk about how we can make things better. What kinds of policies would help boost workers' collective power?
So federally, Congress has introduced the Richard L. Trumka Protecting the Right to Organize Act, which includes some critical reforms that would restore private sector's workers' right to collectively bargain, form unions, and their right to strike. In particular, for the right to strike, the PRO Act, which is what it's called, it prohibits employers from permanently replacing striking workers. And it would also allow the use of secondary strikes or solidarity strikes as well.
Can you say more about solidarity strikes, why they are important and what the law currently allows or doesn't allow?
So the ban on so-called secondary strikes was part of a package of amendments to the original National Labor Relations Act in 1947, the Taft-Hartley Act. And it is one of a number of ways in which that law was weakened, sort of diminishing the intent to create a protected legal right to strike. Prior to those amendments being passed, workers who wanted to support, to show their solidarity with a sister union or a union in their industry or somewhere in their supply chain that was on strike did have the legally protected option to use their collective power to say, we're going to join them. We're going to join them. Maybe it would be for a day. Maybe it would be for a certain length of time, or to say, we're not going to deliver or products or services to the employer that these other workers are in a dispute with, because we want to add to the economic leverage that those workers are trying to bring to bear to improve their jobs. The 1947 amendment made it illegal for workers to use that sort of solidarity pressure. Now, we still see today, even in the absence of that being legally protected, workers often acting in solidarity with each other, and that might mean they're showing up on each other's picket lines. UPS drivers, again, would be an example of an instance where Teamsters have over decades included and retained in their contract the right to refuse delivery when they encounter employers whose workers are on strike, right? So that's a kind of solidarity action that is still protected because they've negotiated it right into their contract. The ability to show that solidarity. So there are all kinds of ways in which workers still show each other solidarity, but that very effective economic leverage of being able to threaten or add their withhold their own labor as an additional layer of strike to pressure an employer to come to the table and negotiate more fully, that has been taken away. And so that's a real limitation and one of the many ways that the imbalance in power between employers and employees has been exaggerated because of policy choices over the last several decades.
What other policies would strengthen the hands of workers in terms of forming unions and their ability to engage in strikes.
So just quickly on the private sector workers, there are two bills that have been introduced in Congress that one would is called the Striking and the Locked Out Workers Healthcare Protection Act, which would prevent employers from cutting off healthcare coverage for workers and their family members, which, as Jen alluded to, does happen sometimes during strikes. And then also there is a recently introduced bill called the Food Secure Strikers Act, which would allow striking workers to qualify for Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program or SNAP benefits, which was something striking workers did have access to up until, I believe, the early 80s. So those are some federal laws that are currently, or federal bills, I should say, that are currently introduced that would bolster workers' right to strike.
Any final thoughts you want to share with us regarding the resurgence of the labor movement and the use of strikes? And Margaret, maybe you can go first.
So despite many obstacles workers are facing under current labor law, workers are still joining unions and going on strike. Data from the National Labor Relations Board actually shows that their caseload, which includes union elections plus unfair labor practice, is the highest it's been since the late 50s. And the BLS data shows that thousands of workers are still going on strike despite certain limitations they are experiencing. So that's really exciting to see these workers forming unions and taking labor actions to really get their fair share of the economy.
And what about you, Jen? Any final thoughts?
Well, I wanted to add at least a mention of the importance of state policy in our current moment, partly because, as we, you know, as Margaret noted, the PRO Act has been introduced and reintroduced. And at a moment when there is, you know, lots of interest in and polling popularity around the notion of strengthening unions, we're still not seeing congressional action. And so what that means is states, where they have latitude to act, really have an important role to play, because we are seeing more progress in areas like, for example, ensuring that farm workers or agricultural workers who have been left out of federal coverage do begin to get rights to unionize and collectively bargain. And that's something that states across the country have lots of room to improve on and can do so often more quickly than we see action from Congress at the federal level. Ensuring that public employees have the right to strike. So as I mentioned, many states have some sort of legal framework for collective bargaining between public employers and employees, but the majority do not guarantee a legally protected right to strike. And we're seeing, you know, very live discussions in states like Massachusetts and some other places about adding that as a new protection. And then similarly, because our unemployment system is primarily a state-based policy system, states have the ability to shore up protections for striking workers by ensuring they're eligible for unemployment insurance. So there are a lot of ways in which states can fill some of the gaps that our federal law has left us.
Jen and Margaret, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
I want to finish the show by picking up on Jen's comment regarding how state policy can also protect workers' right to organize, particularly for those workers excluded from the National Labor Relations Act. The NLRA came into being at a time when Southern states lived by Jim Crow laws, a system of racial segregation and subordination. Opposed to empowering the Black workers who labored in the fields and homes of white families, Southern lawmakers pushed to exclude agricultural and domestic workers from the protections of the NLRA. And sadly, the Roosevelt administration acceded to this devil's bargain. As a report recently published by the Oregon Center for Public Policy explains, the NLRA's racially motivated exclusion remains in place to this day, continuing to disadvantage workers of color. The vast majority of farm workers, both nationally and in Oregon, identify as Latino, while domestic workers are disproportionately Black and Latino women. The effect of excluding farm workers and domestic workers from the right to organize is borne out in their paychecks. Their wages are among the lowest in the state. Five decades ago, California extended to farm workers the right to organize. Our state could choose to end the disparate treatment of farm workers and domestic workers, extending to them the right to organize and the right to go on strike, rights that other private sector workers enjoy. Work is work, and certainly all workers deserve to enjoy the same rights in the workplace. That's it for today's show. We will see you next time.
Hello, and welcome to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. As you know, KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform, which means we are funded by you, the listener. Today, Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time joins us to discuss the sequel Guardians of the Galaxy 3, while Jeff Gonsol tackles the once controversial Where's Papa? But first, here is Jeff on Roman Polanski's The Pianist.
The Pianist from 2002 is the film that Roman Polanski was destined to make. He had wanted to make a film chronicling the occupation of his native Poland by the Nazis, the ghettos, and the eventual extermination of the Jewish population, but he hadn't found the right script or story. Apparently, it wasn't until quite late that he discovered Władysław Spielman's memoir,